This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Nick Stansbury, Head of Climate Solutions, and Stephen Beer, a Senior Manager within our Investment Stewardship team. Good afternoon, everyone.
Afternoon, Max.
Great to be here. Afternoon, Max.
Well, with the Earth on track for its hottest year on record and the COP28 summit due to open later this month, we're going to devote today's episode to the subject of climate change. However, Sonia, before we delve into our main topic, we should pause to survey markets, which have taken on a decidedly more positive tone of late, partly due to some cooler inflation readings. Do you think this is the start of a longer trend in risk assets?
Thanks, Max. And I guess if this year has been any guide, then we should be very careful to read too much into market movements, because it's very clear that one very decisive factor of markets has been that new data flows have been discounted very, very quickly and have been extrapolated into trends very quickly. If we just look at government bonds and the rates market, that I think becomes very obvious. Because if you think back at the beginning of the year, we have been already pricing in peak rates back then. That obviously then changed, and we were going to into the higher for longer narrative because inflationary data was more stubborn than originally anticipated. And it seems that we're now back into the peak rates narrative, because when you look at just at the UK data, the latest is nearly a 200 basis point inflation print lower from the peak, and government bond yields have reacted accordingly. And we have seen quite a sizable swing of roughly 50 basis points in the 10-year gilt. Now, these are big moves, and they have occurred, unfortunately, quite regular this year, demonstrating the underlying market trend and probably signifying the inflection point, because we haven't an established market narrative yet. Now, if we look at the underlying data, the balancing act remains. Inflation is softening without a doubt, but we always knew that particularly the transitory elements, and we will talk about energy and commodity prices today, clearly have been a big part of the upward inflationary pressures in 2022. And obviously the beauty of year-on-year comparison is eventually you will see the big swings being priced out, and as such, obviously the downward pressure on headline inflation in particular. Now, the key, and we have been repeating that for some time, will be the structural drivers of inflation, particularly obviously the services inflation and wage inflation. We are keenly watching whether the labor market is softening, because that will be the indication for the central banks whether they can soften their stance on monetary policy. For the time being, the narrative remains consistent, and central banks are telling us they will do everything to bring inflation under control sustainably. So one reading clearly will not be enough to change that narrative. And this is why it's interesting how quickly markets are pricing in the new narrative. And I wouldn't be surprised that even in 2024, we will see a little bit of back and forth, because for the time being, there is quite a distinct expectation for rate cuts starting by mid-year. Big difference in expectations. But, you know, if we want to understand where potential disappointment can come from, it's clearly that inflation remains higher for longer. And as such, we might still have reached peak rates, but they will stay there for a longer period of time. And that clearly will have an influence on markets. I've attended a conference last week where then the idea of a mountain formation, whether we're talking about a tabletop, right, or whether it's the Mount Everest. And so, you know, steep up and then steep down, I think time will tell. But this will be the driving force behind the market narrative. Volatility remains here to stay. And if 2023 has been any guide, then we have to expect that market participants will react on underlying data at very short notice. Now, if you look at the growth outlook, inflation, as I said, we are on a downward moving trend, but let's not forget we are still way above comfort zone, way above the 2% target that central banks are targeting. And as such, it will depend on whether the economy is indeed slowing down sufficiently for central banks to get comfortable in cutting rates. What we should not forget as well is that in 2024, we will have 50% global GDP going to the polls. We will have election in countries representing 50% of global GDP. And I think all eyes will be undoubtedly on the US, because what will be the second potentially even more important driver of market narrative is politics. Politics already on the back of a very fragile geopolitical environment. We have two wars still ongoing, and we don't know yet how they will come to an end. And we know that particularly the elections in the US have the potential to take a decisive influence on how this narrative will evolve. And although this is not distinctly a 2024 story, it clearly can take a decisive turn depending on how these elections will turn out. So for investors, hence, quite a balancing act, because the near term will continue to be driven by rates and inflation and obviously the underlying economy. But longer term, it's very clear that investors need to prepare what will be the structural drivers of the investable universe and the opportunity set. I think that much we know will be distinctly different. Now, overall in returns, because you said decidedly better, we should not forget that actually most fixed income markets are flat at best, if not negative. So despite the fact we've had a decent, obviously, reduction in yields and upward movement in prices, this is on the back of a really, really difficult market for global fixed income. And even equities, I know we are all looking at headline levels, that still is positive, particularly the NASDAQ is up 36%, but it is all due to the Magnificent Seven. So it is seven stocks only that drive global market returns. And this is, again, something that investors need to be very mindful of, because it's based on another structural driver in the hype around AI that has led to literally the entire equity market return in 2023. Again, the question is how this will unfold. Again, we've talked about thematics and structural drivers. It will remain one, but there will be others that will surely join the fold, and is for investors to make sure they understand and invest accordingly.
Thank you very much, Sonia, for that comprehensive overview. Then I think you're very clear that regardless of whichever rates mountain we're on, we should expect more volatility. And of course, we'll touch on the question of geopolitics later in this call. Well, Nick, as we discussed actually on the call last month, a tragic new conflict broke out in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas. We're going to focus exclusively on the market implications on this call. So question to you is, how is the conflict affecting commodity markets?
The spot price impact has been remarkably muted when you consider the magnitude of the geopolitical shock that's occurred. Around the immediately subsequential time period, so the following 24 trading hours, we saw crude oil trade up low single digits, 3-4% at the end. We saw a slightly more significant move upwards in gas pricing, which is to be expected given the emerging importance of the region for global gas markets and the emergence of the Eastern Mediterranean. It's a very interesting and important new supplier of gas. But even in oil markets, which have historically been very, very sensitive to geopolitical shocks in this part of the world, we're actually now seeing crude pricing trading below where they were before the events took place. Gas pricing does remain somewhat higher, but in general, markets appear to be largely brushing off the financial impact of these events, at least as commodity markets go.
Thank you, Nick. And a follow-up question is, does the new interest rate environment that Sonia was discussing earlier, which is resulting in higher capital costs for companies, does that mean investment in renewables must inevitably slow down?
Yeah, also a good question. It's worth stepping back and looking at that in some big picture context first. All parts of the energy system are capital intensive, and therefore, whether you are drilling an oil well, building a new coal mine, building a new nuclear power station, or building an offshore wind farm, what goes on in the world of interest rates matters. But it is undoubtedly the case that renewables are far more interest rate sensitive or capital cost sensitive than other parts of the energy system. One way of thinking about that is to say, okay, if we saw a 400 basis point change in the long-term interest rate assumption that you might embed into a financial model to work out break-even pricing of electricity sold, and you would see that a 400 basis point change in interest rates, falls through to about a 4 percentage point change in what we call the levelized cost of electricity, LCOE, of a CCGT or a gas-fired power station. But if we looked at the same thing for a utility-scale solar project or utility-scale offshore wind project, we might see an upward shift in the resultant LCOE of maybe 30 percentage points. So you've got something like 7 to 8 times the interest rate sensitivity in renewables than you do in other parts of the energy system. And that has undoubtedly put a distinct kink in the long-term trends that we've been observing around deflation in renewables. And for the first time in many years, we're probably looking at nominal LCOEs for renewables being flat to up for the next 36 months, which, given that we're coming off 20 plus years of steady and ever surprising deflation in the renewable industry, that is a significant shock. Is that enough to derail progress? And does it mean that we need to be really rethinking our long-term assumptions around this? We don't think so, because whilst a 30% change in pricing is significant, in the context of the cost deflation that we think is still to come, we think it's easily absorbable. And we think you do have to think about it in the context of everything having become more expensive. That said, we do need to be realistic. And if we look at the amount of renewable additions that we can see being added to the global energy system this year, and we look at it in the context of where we would need to be seeing those additions, we're adding possibly as little as 1/3 of the global renewable capacity as we need to if we were to be on track for a 1.5 degree outcome. So interest rates, do they completely derail it? No. Is it an important driver of cost we need to be aware of? Yes. Are we on track? No, we're not on track.
Okay, that's a very clear, if sobering, answer. Thank you, Nick. Stephen, in light of Nick's remarks, what are your expectations of the COP28 climate summit?
Well, the first thing to say, and to the parties, it's the world getting together to try and come to an agreement or a series of agreements about how to progress towards that goal of keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees, of ensuring that we've got the transition on track. And in terms of general expectations, we should expect it to be hard. We should expect people to disagree, because that's what happens at these kind of global conferences. So, you know, when I think about COPs, I think, yeah, it's tough. If you're sitting there as a negotiator, these things are always tough, which is why when there's agreement, it is a very big deal. So that's the backdrop. I would say if you look at the current COP, COP28, the backdrop is that last year's COP, COP27, was a bit disappointing. It left the world clinging to that 1.5 degree target, but without much of a clear idea on how to meet it. A loss and damage fund was agreed in principle to direct funding to countries that most need it to adapt and mitigate climate change. However, there were no details in particular that were agreed. And of course, as we get to this COP, there's the backdrop not only of the financing and inflation challenges that we've just been talking about, but also the world's very aware that it's been a particularly hot year, combination of a warming world and El Nino weather patterns. So that's the sort of backdrop. And when delegates get there, they'll be confronted with the global stocktake, which is the big review of what the progress the world is making to keep temperature rises to 1.5 degrees. And a technical report linked to that was released in September, and it made for grim reading. There is a big gap when you get to 2030. There's a big gap between where emissions are projected and where we should be. So it's going to be a sobering backdrop before anybody starts. In terms of the wider or more specific expectations, I would say, let's see what we get. We would hope to get some detail on loss and damage. Definitions would be helpful to understand what financing actually is and means and where it would actually go. The same is true for the $100 billion target for climate finance for developing countries. And the same is true for long-term targets, new goals to shift finance around. There's a lot of debate about, well, if only we can move these trillions from A to B. And I think this is where the financial sector plays a part, because we understand markets and how they work. We understand businesses and industry. And I think that's where the dialogue between finance and government is so important. There's likely too to be a debate about fossil fuels, of course. You know, a debate will probably focus around phasing out or phasing down fossil fuels. What does it actually mean? So I think the expectations are going to be probably better, but exceeded compared with where they were a year ago in terms of potential outcomes, but probably still likely to be a long way to go. I'd say just to add to that, these debates reflect and are reflected in some way the kind of conversations we're having with companies. As we're getting closer to those key dates, 2030, 2050, it's becoming more and more apparent what companies and what the world needs to do, and more the costs and benefits are becoming more apparent. That makes the conversations harder edged. Not always harder, but harder edged. We're talking about reality here, not about a promise that someone might have to fulfill, you know, sometime in the future in some indistinct way. It really, really matters. So the conversations are harder edged, but the outcomes therefore can have real world impact much more effectively than perhaps they would have done 5 years ago.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. That's a really good list of things to watch out for, and I suppose metrics by which to judge the success of the summit as well. And let's return to the question of what we say to companies too. Sonia, going back to your earlier remarks about the geopolitical environment, to what extent does this increasingly fragmented backdrop make it harder to tackle climate change and other pressing issues?
Yes, based on what Stephen just told us, this is a very obvious answer. It makes it a lot harder. And we have to assume that the level of fragmentation and the move towards a multipolar world will increasingly be apparent in those negotiations and in the attempt to come to an agreement. And as such, you know, we have to always remind ourselves that climate change is a global problem statement. And as such, it requires, and we always knew this, a level of global collaboration that we've never seen before. Now we're trying to attempt this in an environment where we're probably moving further away from an aligned global world order. And as such, you will have an inevitable conflict. Mm. And I think what Stephen just said is very interesting, because we are asking on top people and politicians, so it can be management teams of companies and politicians, to put in place measures today that go well beyond their tenure in office or as the manager of a company, where, again, you very often find a conflict of interest in how people consider the problem statement that is so far out with measures that have to be put in place today, where very often, this is particularly true on the company level, the payoff is very uneven and different to a project that probably is not having that long-term focus, and that are questions that are real and where we need to step in and help and answer those. Because if you are the CFO of a company and you have two competing projects, one with a very clear climate-aligned goal that is far further out versus one that potentially doesn't, you will find very often that the payback times and the internal rate of returns are favoring the shorter term payback. So these are real world questions. It's the same if you then think about this on a bigger picture level, same question for a politician. We have a mismatch. The normal political timeframe does not align to solve problems that are so far out. And this is just on a regional level, but I'm saying it again because we very often try to look at this as if the UK is solving its, you know, carbon emission problems. That is great, but unfortunately it will not tackle global climate change. Nick has very nicely called this out in a prior episode of our podcast. It is the global south that will decide on how successful we will tackle climate change. And again, there is a role to play, obviously, of the global north. But again, we have to be very realistic where the key levers are that need to be pulled. But I thought calling out the misalignment that we have in interest is probably the key that we need to focus on. And this will be double, triple as hard in a world where we have so much friction occurring on a geopolitical level.
So really interesting, powerful observation there, the difference between cyclical earnings and elections and the long-term action that needs to happen. Well, Stephen, let's return to the question of what we can do as investors there on those long-term actions.
Well, the key thing about tackling climate change is that each part of society, each part of the economy needs to play their part. So no one part can do it alone. So the simple answer is play our part, whether we're investors or companies or members of other organizations or just individuals. What is it that we can actually do to contribute to reducing systemic risk of climate change? And I think as investors and investment managers, that's what we're concerned about. We were concerned about the systemic risks that can be long-term and that bleed into very big uncertainties that we want to reduce or at least define a bit better. And so it's important to reduce those risks, to reduce that risk of loss or lower returns, even if it's some way into the future, because however far in the future it may be, as it becomes more apparent, it will affect us right here and now. So how can we do that as investors and how can others do it? Well, the key thing, I think, is to encourage those companies in which we're invested to take the steps that they need to in the appropriate time frame to transition effectively. And that's simply said, but there is a lot that companies need to do. We can point to some companies that are doing it well, but most companies still have a long, long way to go. And it's about saying, well, do you even know what your own emissions are? And are you disclosing them? And do you have targets to reduce those emissions? Is your business plan aligned to a 1.5 degree world? Are you in some way promoting through your business activities a world that is unaligned, a world that might be more aligned to 3 degrees or 4 degrees? And if so, you are creating risks, not just for yourself as a company, but you're creating risks across companies and across markets. And that's why we engage in that way. But it's not simply about, are you aligning to what a 1.5 degree world might look like? It's, are you aligning to what the economy might look like in that scenario? It will look very, very different to the way it operates today. How we use energy will be very different. And so companies need to adjust and adapt to that. Otherwise, they'll have their own risks to future profits, and the future profits of other companies too.
Well, I mean, to bring that to life, are there any highlights from recent engagements with companies that illustrate this approach?
Well, we engage extensively on climate in LGM, and particularly through our Climate Impact Pledge. We assess well over 5,000 companies. We always engage with consequences. So where companies aren't meeting our minimum expectations, there will be vote sanctions that follow. And there were 299 vote sanctions through our quantitative analysis in this past year that we identified. And, you know, we talk to companies, we write to them, we engage with them about what our expectations are. We publish those expectations. It's vitally important that you signal what you expect. But then we also engage. We identified well over 100 companies to engage with, particularly where they might move the dial on climate change, both for themselves and for others. And one of the things you could say there is that we want every company to be aligned on climate lobbying. So we want all their lobbying to be aligned with 1.5 degrees and not to be doing one thing in one place and saying something in another. For example, with Toyota, we've engaged extensively on lobbying. We voted on a shareholder resolution that was talking about lobbying and pushing that company to do more. It has done more. It has not done, in our view, as much as we would like. And those conversations continuing alongside our encouragement of it, of that company to move more into EVs and to develop its solid state battery technology. We've been engaging with Nucor, which is a steel company, pushing it to adopt science-based targets, independently verified targets. It's recently announced that it's doing so. And in our climate pledge divestment list, we've had for a while China Mengniu Dairy, which we've just taken off that list because it's now adopted a deforestation policy, taken other measures that we think are encouraging on that route to net zero. Has it done enough? No, but it's moved, and we've recognised that and recognised that publicly. So no company is ever going to be perfectly right there. Now, of course, we're not going to be the only people engaging on these issues. And that's part of what I was saying earlier about everyone playing their part. There will be other investors with the same message too. And it's about everyone pushing that message, and then we get to see change.
Thanks, Stephen. And I like the idea there of the carrot of praise and the stick of sanctions that investors need to wield. Well, Nick, I know you believe investors should start considering how much capital to allocate to firms that may not yet be fully positioned for the net zero economy, but have the potential to be. What does this mean in practice?
If we go back and look objectively at the data, we can see that over the past 10 years, listed corporates in aggregate have not decarbonized at all. And where we stand today, that they're still emitting in an absolute sense, essentially the same number of tons of GHGs today that they were emitting 10 years ago. We can see that only a small minority of companies we would be confident were on track for being aligned with even a below 2 degree climate outcome. And many fewer even for that aligned with 1.5 degrees. And we're convinced that far from being just too risky, that there are some enormous opportunities in going after some of those companies that have the potential to be successfully aligned with the Paris goals, but aren't there yet. And that is because every single part of our economy is going to be affected in some way by the energy transition, and it is going to have implications for essentially every company in the world. We tend to think about climate change as being risky for oil companies and sort of vaguely important for everybody else to do something about. But the energy transition is far more complicated than that. And every time we look at a new company, we can see new and exciting areas of opportunity for that business. And so we are increasingly focused in trying to hunt down those businesses who are the potential winners from the energy transition, if only they would just lean into the opportunities that it creates harder for them. We think that there are four probably really plausible levers of value creation to go after. And we think the companies that turn often other investors have spent an awful lot of their time focused on companies that either have already transitioned or are already really well positioned for that transition or have already decarbonized. But actually, those aren't the companies that need the incremental capital. Almost every decarbonisation choice that is out there for companies to do is something which is going to involve them building a more capital intensive solution to the problem than the one they have today. I think it's obvious. You think about what would you do in your own house? Well, you'd insulate your house. That will lower the running costs in terms of your energy bills, but involves you having to capex on your house. Same is true of companies. If you want to decarbonize the business, you'll be lowering your energy consumption in some way, but you'll be doing it through a higher upfront injection of capital. And so if we want to have impact as investors, we can see that it is the companies that haven't yet done everything they need to do and the ones that are high carbon that are the ones where we need to be allocating our capital. And we think the same is broadly true of the opportunities too. From here, we think the really exciting places to be investing if you want to make money out of the energy transition are not necessarily those companies that have already put themselves in a perfect position, but the ones which could do but haven't done it yet.
Thank you very much, Nick, for that perspective. And I would point our listeners to your white paper earlier this year that builds on the argument you've just laid out. Well, Sonia, as always, we've covered a lot of ground in today's podcast. Is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Yes, because I think it's worth trying to tie it all together in at least provide some guidance and a view on what we make of this, because we've called out obviously the long-term nature not only of the problem but very much of the solution as well. And we've talked about the companies and politicians having the difficulty of aligning very long-term goals with short-term measures. The same is true for investors. What we find is that clearly the market reaction function on these long-term themes has been very muted. And we have not seen yet the level of differentiation we do expect from companies doing the right thing and aligning them to a 1.5 degree outcome. And it's important for investors to understand that clearly the rest of this year, early next year, it is not climate change that will dominate the market narrative. It will be the economic cycle. It will be inflation and interest rates. But it is the opportunity to look at the market backdrop and judge the risk and obviously potentially use volatility to think about the positioning for the long term. Again, we are very clear that the way these financial benefits that Nick has highlighted will not be very neatly aligned to the journey to net zero, because it is something that clearly against the market backdrop and for individual companies will look very different. Investing in the climate transition requires a long-term horizon, because we're talking about targets in 2050. But we very strongly believe that the reward, and once the market gets more comfortable and where there's more transparency around the data, that there's a huge opportunity to be found. I should add as well that we still believe that the economy will weaken, and this is why I focused on the idea of more volatility and the entry point. So we still believe that interest rates do work, and as such, you know, the idea of peak rates and a soft landing, we struggle with, and we continue with our view that even for the US, we expect a significant slowdown in economic activity. But it is the balancing act between understanding the long-term structural drivers and making sure you understand where you want to position yourself. And I think the podcast today has highlighted one area where we very strongly believe are huge opportunities.
Thanks, Sonia. And finally, before we wrap up, just like to ask everyone in the room what you've been watching, reading, or listening to. Nick, would you like to get the ball rolling?
Well, my reading list is always comprised of books in two categories. So I've got the things that I'm supposed to be reading and the things that I'm reading instead. At the moment, in the list of things that I'm supposed to be reading are a bunch of books on the benefits of eating plant-based food, which my wife has set out for me to read. And the things that I am reading instead are rereading some of the Sharp novels, particularly Waterloo, which is much more fun.
Such a big Bernard Cornwell fan. Okay, great. I'll go next. Big love Sharp. Anyway, I've been watching an anime series on Netflix called Blue Eyed Samurai. It's a lot of fun and a great distraction. Stephen, over to you.
I'm finally reading the Rosetsky March, which is a novel by Joseph Roth, which is one of those novels where you don't really want it to finish because you want to stay in that world, and so I'm enjoying that. I have a list of books on climate change to read, but that does come into a rather different category, I think. And still very much enjoying Business History podcasts, which I'm a regular listener to.
Great, thank you, Sonia.
I will finish on a more lighthearted note, because it was my son's birthday last weekend, and he made me watch The Marvels. It's the first of these series that I was supposed to, which I had to watch, and it is fun. It's not that I'm going out now and watch all the others, but it was okay, and he was very happy. And of course, we have watched the cricket final on Sunday. Unfortunately, not necessarily in favour of my husband. A great match. And I think the whole India team should be very proud of what they've achieved and what they delivered throughout the tournament.
Well, it's a lovely note on which to end today's call. Thank you, Sonia, Stephen and Nick, for your time today. And thank you to our clients and listeners for joining us. Our next edition of this podcast and the last one for the year will be in December, when Sonia will be joined by Will Riley, Howie Lee and Emil van den Heiligenberg to discuss our 2024 investment outlook. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates on our social media channels, on the LGIM blog, and of course, here on LGIM Talks.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are by their nature subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website, To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2023. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.